So I'm just popping in. I just said I'd come to one, and I forgot to do the main announcement that I came for last week. So the reason I'm dressed like this is I just taught yoga. So everything here, how many people think that we get money from FPMT? You're just being cantankerous. I know him. He's a plug. So you're wrong, sir. So your wife's here to tell you, too, so it's consistent, right? So we just want to let you guys know we're kind of beefing up some announcements and letting people know things that there's no money that comes from any outside source to our center. And I think a lot of times in churches we think that it comes from foundations or it comes from on high or it comes from the mother organization and things. So we want to let people know that everything here is funded by here and that nothing we do we charge for. And it's so rare that I could say I think we're the only one in the United States that doesn't charge for anything. And most classes, most centers, if you went somewhere, you'd actually pay for the course or you'd pay for the retreat. We do charge for retreats, but they're not for the teachings. It's just going to be for your housing and food. So it's pretty darn unusual. And if there's so many new people, I kind of thought, you know, you guys probably don't know that. So there's such a golden opportunity to let you know that you can give when the Spirit moves you. There's envelopes everywhere. You can pay online. You can donate whenever you feel like it. There she just got an envelope. See? How moving was this speech? Thank you for that example. What else? So is this the teacher? Good. Hey, Don. So that's it. I just want to let you know, too, that I teach yoga every Monday at 5:30 if you ever want to join that. Thank you.
So you want to sit up straight, back straight, arms in the lap. Typically, your arms a little bit away from the body, but you want your shoulders back and down. It's like a really proper posture because you want to be alert. Chin a little tucked in, slightly tucked in. The eyes maybe slightly open. Throw some light in if that's not too distracting. The tongue at the roof of the mouth. Take two or three exaggerated breaths, and as you exhale, imagine all the tension from the day leaving the body and the mind. And I want you to pay attention to the body and what it feels like to be sitting. Where your hands are in relation to your lap, your head, your shoulders, your arms, your torso, your seat, your legs, feet. And you want to notice whatever it is you're experiencing in the body. And notice that whatever you're experiencing, if it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that it's in a constant moment-to-moment state of change, constant state of flux. and just being aware of the body, even today or tomorrow, whenever your mind gets a little wild, just bring it back to your experience of the body. Immediately there's a little freedom, a moment of freedom. You're not swept away in your thought processes. And pay attention to the sounds, whatever sounds you hear, whether you find these pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Notice how they're changing. Notice the mind, notice how thoughts dominate your experience. And if it's, again, you want to notice how it feels. Is it pleasant or is it unpleasant or neutral? If your mind's dominated by something like anger or boredom, fear, attachment, wanting, aversion, whatever it is, you just notice the mind going in one direction and then another. You can gently label it fear or even wondering. Whatever dominates our mental experience at the moment, it could be perceptions in the body, it could be sounds, it could be taste, smells, sensory sensations, whatever it is, we just notice it, completely open to it, without any judgment, just noticing it. Noticing how we feel about it, whatever the experience that predominates in the mind at the moment, that's what we're paying attention to. The Dalai Lama says, a great yogi is someone who's focused on the next moment of consciousness with clarity and awareness. A great yogi or meditation master, someone focused on the next moment of consciousness with clarity and awareness. Because the present moment's already passed, isn't it? Focusing on the next moment of consciousness. Mind's distracted, you notice that. You might just say, mentally label wandering, mind wandering. Let's turn, is there a way to turn the AC? Isn't it warm in here?
Mm-hmm.
Just need a little bit of air circulating. We're going to go on page 34 and 35. These are typical, the traditional prayers that we do. So we just do the first, taking refuge and generating, bodhicitta and the four immeasurables. And remember, and before you get it, before you say this, because, we don't want our practice to become meaningless. Just saying words without understanding why we're saying it or having no feeling for the words. And, I understand most people here aren't Buddhist, so that's fine. But as those of, practicing Buddhists, before they would say these words, would understand that the first two lines, and I've said this before, we're going for refuge until we're enlightened. Okay, but why are we going for refuge? Remember, we talked about the three reasons for going for refuge. One was, and I'll review those in a minute, because I think it's probably the most important part of this class. The first is sometimes called fear, sometimes called dread. What's another good word? I thought of another one the other day, but I can't remember it. But just acknowledging that, we have, with the kind of minds that we have, never going to be satisfied, ever, 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 impossible, with the kind of minds we have. If you're an ordinary being like I am, impossible to ever be satisfied. That is not a good thing. Because never be happy. You can only have momentary happiness with that kind of mind. So we have to get, and this is the practice of a lifetime, by the way, the practice of refuge. This isn't four lines, this little thing. This is the practice of a lifetime. It's getting to know your mind and realizing how out of control it is, and in the context of understanding that you can do something about it, not just, oh my God, this is a mess, but I can actually do something about it if I practice. So we have, first of all, we have this real sense of dread, and then confidence. Well, there's no way to have confidence without practice, is it? Because what do you have? It's not totally true. This is why we talked about the importance of a really great Dharma practitioner as a teacher who lives and breathes this, so that we get a real sense of, I would like to have what that person has, and like, wouldn't it be great to be completely joyful and free and happy and resilient in every conceivable situation. It's really nice to meet somebody that has those qualities. And I think it brings the teachings to life. I think without that, we're at a disadvantage, because this is like eating, I'm sorry, but this class is like eating saltines. It really is. I mean, there's no moisture. Really having an example of, like Geshe Gelug or the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa, some of the masters that, the people that really are exemplars of the teachings, it makes a big difference. So there's just this faith which takes time. I mean, as we practice, we can begin to see our mind shifting and moving in the direction that we want it to. That brings faith. But I think it takes more than that. But it's a big, having our own practice yield fruit, and our mind being happier and so forth. Again, practice of a lifetime, isn't it? So refuge, might start out with a little refuge, at the beginning of your Dharma career. Maybe later on in your career, it's like unshakable. You're so sure that this is what you're so committed. But at some point, it's helpful to make the commitment. And then the third is the compassion, the importance of compassion. This is not really just, I haven't heard great explanations for it, other than, for example, having compassion for ourselves is part of the reason we take refuge, but also compassion for other beings. Like, we see the suffering in the world, and as Mahayana practitioners, we want to help stop it. We want to help We want to make a difference. We want to be a positive difference. So it's that compassion. So we want a path that will help us become more capable beings in terms of eliminating other suffering. And so, you know, in that sense, the Mahayana motive of compassion, great compassion, is brought into this motivation. So again, it's dread of what? Dread of our own mind and what a mess it is, and how you know, we have a lot of work to do. So we have that. It's a healthy dread. It's not a bad thing. And then the next one is confidence or faith, and it's based on real experience and reasoning. You reason, you tested the Dharma, makes sense, doesn't harm you, doesn't harm others. You see your mind moving in the direction you want to go. You meet these extraordinary beings who are great examples of what it can do. Okay, and gradually, you know, get a little bit of faith. Nothing Don Brown's going to say is going to give you faith. You have to dig it out yourself. As Lama Yeshe said, you know, it's up to you to prove these teachings are right. It's a very scientific, you know, it's a scientific method. It's up to us. The teachings are here. Now it's up to us to see if it works for us. We have to see if this is really useful for our mind. And if it's not, it's completely, this is so sweet, it's completely okay to leave. Nobody's begging anybody to stay. It's really, we have to bring some energy to this practice. It's up to us to find the juice here, to find, you know, something useful for ourselves, and put it into practice in our lives. And if you find that this is like the wrong medicine for your mind, you're getting worse or whatever, it's really okay not, you know, to not do it. It's really okay. So I like that, right? That gave me a lot of breathing room when I first got interested in Buddhism. It was like, test it out yourself. Make sure it works. Make sure it makes some sense. Buddhism's always been that way. It's always been like an invitation. You come and check it out. The Buddha said, check it out. Check it out for yourself. Great. If it works for you, then that's great. Then you should put it into practice. All right, so the first two lines differentiate people who are not Buddhist from Buddhists. So I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. Because once we get enlightened, we don't need a refuge, do we? We actually become the source of refuge. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. So the enlightened beings, the Dharma, it's not just these books. These books, we call them Dharma books, but that's not the Dharma. The Dharma is a realization in the minds of these special beings. And the Supreme Assembly, and there are lots of different ways to talk about it, but we use the word Sangha, S-A-N-G-H-A, and there are different levels of Sangha members. In the West, we kind of tend to say, okay, we're all Sangha, you know, we're all, but really, we're not Sangha, we're just Dharma friends. There's a little bit more detail, you know, we have to meet a few more qualifications before we actually become the Sangha. But there you go. Go for refuge until enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So this differentiates somebody who's a Buddhist from somebody who's not a Buddhist. Then it says, by practicing giving and the other perfections. So the six perfections are generosity or giving, ethics. And they're in this order for a reason, although I forgot them the other week, but I remember. I think I remember them now. So there's generosity and ethics, and then there's patience or tolerance, and then there's enthusiastic effort, because without effort, there's no possibility of making any progress. Then there's concentration, so the mind like a laser, and then wisdom, which is seeing things as they are, seeing reality as it is. So by practicing, and these are called the Bodhisattva perfections. So these are the perfections of someone on the Mahayana path, not the path of individual liberation, which, you know, we think of that as the Theravada tradition or the individual liberation. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. And sometimes people see it as a put down, but I don't. I think it's probably realistically where all of us are. Maybe we're aspiring Mahayanas, but we're really doing it for ourselves now. But, you know, there's the Theravada tradition where the goal for practice is individual liberation. But the Mahayana practice, the great vehicle practice, is to do it, is like, the goal is to help others. How do I do it? I do these six perfections. I practice these to the best of my ability. Then I can really make a difference in people's lives. Then I can really have a profound effect. So it's like that. By the practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So this is the differentiation between within Buddhism, between those whose goal is individual liberation and those whose goal is supreme enlightenment for the sake of others, which is the Mahayana vehicle, which is what we aspire to practice at Kadampa Center. So that's what we're saying as we say these. Now, sometimes you can visualize. Some people are good at visualization. I don't know how many are good at it, but you know, if I ask you to like visualize your car right now, you'd instantly be able to do that, wouldn't you? In your mind's eye, most of you would see your Lexus or Mercedes or BMW or whatever you drove here. You know, you'd see it immediately in your mind's eye. So in the same way, you could visualize the Buddha in front of you and think that the Buddha symbolizes all three objects of refuge, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You could do that visualization as you say that. And again, imagine light and nectar coming in and purifying the body as we say it three times. So this is a traditional way to do it. Put the hands at the heart. And like we said, almost every spiritual tradition has people putting their hands at the heart. So I'm not sure what it means. I've heard people say maybe it means by putting your hand here, it helps you speak from the heart. I like that explanation. And in Buddhism, again, we talked about this Tibetan tradition. You put your thumbs together, and it's like you're holding a wish-fulfilling gem, which symbolizes all sentient beings. So you're really holding all living beings at your heart. Kind of think like that as you say it. So we'll do this three times, and we'll do the four measurables. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Like I said, some of these things tonight are going to be repetition. I think that's not a bad thing. If you come to Kadampa Center, you'll hear the same thing said over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. You go, oh my gosh, they're talking about that again. You know, but you know, even these great lamas who actually teach these subjects in the monasteries and have actually, you know, I went to a teaching one time, and the Dalai Lama was in India. The Dalai Lama was there teaching, and his teachers were there listening to him teach something they taught him. So it's not like it was new, but they wanted to hear it again. You know, we hear it again and again. Every time we hear it, there are two teachings going on, right? There's the speaker is saying whatever he or she's saying, And then we're listening and we're working with it. We're saying, does this make sense? Is this helpful? Is this logical? How can I use this information to help my mind? And one of the things that I love the name Kadampa, and I didn't really know what it meant when I first heard it. But the term Kadampa is a Tibetan term. It was a group of these great masters from Tibet, and Kadampa means that these particular people that practice this way, they saw all the Buddhist teachings as personal advice for them. Personal advice for them and their practice. So, you know, that's the invitation. Let's listen. Let's try to learn something and see and see it as personal advice for our practice. So, I'm going to go back over the Four Noble Truths again. Yeah. Wait a minute. Flip chart marker. Doesn't sound good, does it? Sounds like a permanent marker. I don't want to do that one. So what are the Four Noble Truths? What are those of you who were paying attention last week or have studied this stuff a million times? What's the first truth? Remember I talked about it.
The truth of suffering.
Go ahead.
Suffering.
Suffering. What was a euphemism for suffering?
Complications.
The Dalai Lama said, "Very." You remember that example I gave? Truth of complications. Did you? Yeah. Thank you. I don't know if complications. The Sanskrit word is dukkha. So I'm gonna call this the four NTs, noble truths, right? Four noble truths. All right. So these are truths known by people. This puts us all down, by the way. This is these are truths seen by people who can really see the truth. So I hope we're that one. You know, that's us. But let's see. Sometimes called Arya beings. Truth of so. Suffering, you know, dukkha, you see this word a lot if you read, not that much, but dukkha, so we'll call it suffering. And it's not just obvious suffering. Geshe Gelug calls it, and the Dalai Lama call it complications. So I'm going to use this word suffering, and sometimes we talk about three major kinds of suffering. One of them is obvious suffering. Like if you broke a leg, pretty obvious, isn't it? If you're stressed out or really depressed or it's a lot of conflict in your life and stuff like that, it's obvious suffering of body and mind. And easy to recognize. So sometimes we call that the suffering of suffering. Alright. The next one is the one you don't want me to talk about, but I have to. It's called the suffering of change. Suffering of change. And this was a lot harder to see because it, you know, and this again, Buddhist teaching, so we're inviting you to listen to this and see if this makes sense, but it's basically saying, I'll give you an example. It was hot when I walked in, right? For me. So they turned the AC on. Now I've gone from being comfortable, now I'm a little chilly. it changed. But it stopped right in the middle. But it didn't go that way. So it's like everything that we experience, that we now label as pleasant, cause of happiness, all of that stuff. You can, all the stuff that we're addicted to that's delicious, right? Gaining. Remember the four major categories were pleasure, gain, fame and praise. So all of those things that we're addicted to and that we live, honestly, in this culture, we live for this, don't we? This is what we live for. You know, if somebody has had, they've got a lot of toys when they die, and they've had a lot of pleasant experiences, and their reputation's good, and people praise them and stuff like that, we say, he really or she really lived a good life. We say that, don't we? That constitutes a good life in the ordinary pedestrian conversation. But every one of these experiences that we literally live for change. They don't last. You get something, you know, talked to a guy today, bought a new boat 16 years ago. He had to call the junk squad to come and take it away a couple of weeks ago. I wanted that boat. I asked him, you know, but he said, you wouldn't want that boat. It was a piece of junk. I had to get somebody to take it away. So everything changes. You know, go on a nice vacation. And it's so nice when you get there. And about 4 or 5 days, you're ready to come home. So, you know, I'm done. I'm ready for my bed. Everything that we now call the source of pleasure and everything, all the things that we're addicted to, change. And they don't last. And it leaves us wanting more. That's why we can never be satisfied with the kind of minds we have. Because we project onto these delicious things true happiness, and they never deliver because they go out of existence. They change, and then they're impermanent. And so we're left, well, what's next? And so, you know, it's not like we're bleeding, but it is change, and it's not satisfying. It leaves us like with a dissatisfied mind. And Lama Zopa, one of my teachers, said, it's the worst suffering in samsara. It's not so obvious. It's like having one of those radiation badges. You know, you see people in the hospital, in the X-ray department. They wear these little badges to see how much radiation they're getting, and they don't really see it all day long. But it's like low-level radiation that's killing us, destroying our happiness and our potential for lasting satisfaction and happiness. So I invite you to look at this. Now, don't. You know, Don Brown said it, but I'm just repeating what I've heard. And then the last one is almost impossible to see, unless you really, really think about it and study and understand your own mind. It's called sometimes pervasive suffering. Pervasive suffering. Anyway, pervasive suffering. It's like this. It's like, and this gets into the having a Buddhist view of the world, cosmological view of the world, but it's like basically we're caught in a process of uncontrolled causation. We're caught in, one of the first members, I'm not going to mention his name, but one of the first guys who started coming to these classes many years ago, and he told me, I said, why did you come to these classes? He said, well, I just kept doing the same thing over and over again. You know, I'd do it and it didn't work, and I'd try it again and it wouldn't work, and I'd try it again and it wouldn't work, and I was exhausted by that. So we're caught in this cycle. We call it cyclic existence. I guess there might be other words for it. Cyclic existence is good. A process of uncontrolled causation. We're caught in this, and we don't see it. And it's going on in this lifetime. I promise you, if you check it out and you've lived long enough, you can see how you do the same thing again and again, thinking it's going to get better. It doesn't. Anybody have that experience? Most everybody. But it's really even from lifetime to lifetime. In Buddhism, we say, you know, you just do the same thing from lifetime to lifetime. And this is wild, but Buddha says our consciousness has been around forever. There's no beginning in a timeline. And it makes sense. If this is now, right, zero, and you're going back this way, I mean, how could you say that if you say, well, that's the beginning, well, there had to be something there before that, right? There's no point in time when you can say that's the beginning, because there had to be something before it. So we talk about consciousness that way, as beginningless. There's no beginning to our consciousness, and there's no end to our consciousness. Now, there can be an end to confusion, so I'm not saying that. There's a possibility of enlightenment. This is what they claim in Buddhism. But we are caught in this process of uncontrolled causation, and it's not only going to destroy our happiness in this lifetime, but in the next life and the one after that and the one after that, if we don't wake up, we're going to be in the same mess, the same boat. And the best example I've heard of this is kind of like you have a big burn on your arm, you know, that burns all the skin away, and then it hurts all the time, but then somebody pours some cool water on it. You go, oh boy, that feels so good. Pleasant. We call that happiness. We label that happiness. But what's the underlying problem? A burn. A burn that hurts like heck. You know, a really bad burn. Just a momentary diminishing of that suffering, we label it happiness. Now check it out and see if that makes sense. That's the claim. So we live we can have moments of great joy, great happiness, not to say that it doesn't exist, but it doesn't last, and right there underneath it is a mind that's completely out of control. 99.9% of the time driven by egocentricity. It's going to cause more problems. So this is, you know, in terms of trying to develop a real dread, you know, you want to go to refuge. It's important because we can't have, if we don't have enough compassion for ourselves to want to escape, you know, there's no possibility to have any motivation to practice. So we've got to come to terms with the human condition. And it's not to say, Buddhism is not saying that fun and great sex and beautiful sunsets and great meals and a good bottle of wine or whatever makes you happy in the moment is suffering. But it won't last and you'll want more, and it's not the true cause of happiness. If it were, you could just keep doing it more and more and more and more and more, and it'd just make you happier and happier and happier. But it doesn't work that way, does it? Doesn't work that way. Sooner or later you get disgusted and you realize that whatever it is, it's not going to bring me to what I really want in my heart of hearts, which is true lasting happiness. So again, we're trying to get the motivation to develop a sense of dread, healthy dread. And the other one, again, this is called truth of dukkha, suffering, truth of the causes. Okay, so this is saying you're sick. Now, this cause of your sickness is streptococcus, you know, or a bleeding ulcer, or a tumor, or whatever it is. But, you know, the Buddha is saying you're sick, there's a cause for it. And the cause is karma. And this is one of the crucial things in Buddhism that is so important to develop a feeling for it. Even though you, now here's a cop out. It sounds like a cop out. It still sounds like a cop out to me. But I have a lot of faith in karma. In fact, I'm really afraid of karma. But it's a good thing, I think. Because I believe that everything I do comes back to me in spades. So if I hurt somebody else, I just shot myself in the foot. Any little lack of kindness comes back to me too. So having that kind of awareness that what goes around comes around, goes around comes around. I was trying to teach this to my kids this weekend. The oldest one, so she's going to be 14 tomorrow. She says, I don't believe in that anymore. I said, well, you know, maybe just be open. Creatively align here. But when she was littler, she was a little bit more, you know, before she reached the age of reason, I guess. But anyway, we used to do a lot of purification practices at my house. But so karma and delusions. These are the principal delusions. We talk about three poisons: greed, hatred, and ignorance. But you can add pride, jealousy. Well, and then you can add 84,000 more to that. So the list of confused states of mind are many. But any action motivated by, say, for example, fear or anger is going to plant seeds in our mental continuum that can lead to suffering. So, and by the same token, kindness, any act of motivated by selflessness is going to plant the causes for happiness. But most of the time, the Buddha's saying the causes of this illness are karma and delusions. Now, if we motivate, if we thought about this, end up for some time and examine our life through the lens of these teachings, and we get a real genuine sense of dread, fear, concern. I think that's a great word. I'm really concerned about my future. If this is true, if this is really how things operate, I need to be concerned about it. So, again, these meditating, thinking about the first two truths help us develop a stronger sense of dread or fear, which is the first cause for going for refuge. And the third one, remember this one? There's no other spiritual tradition in the world, and certainly no psychological system or, psychotherapist could verify this. Nobody posits that you could stop your suffering, but the Buddha did. The truth of the cessation. So all this is happening in the context of the fact that, we're looking at the reality of our lives now, and we don't need to be stuck here thinking, well, I'm screwed. This is terrible. Yeah, it's terrible, but the Buddha's saying it's a possibility to stop it. But the only way to stop it is to do the work and see reality as it is. So what does that mean? So we'll talk about that some more, but the truth of the cessation of suffering is what he's talking about. So we're sick. There's a cause for the sickness. Great news. We can be cured. This is the best news. And then the way we can be cured is to take the medicine. And the medicine is the truth of the path. All right? And at Kadampa Center, we teach, in a real broad sense, it's three paths. There's like ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, there's the three paths, but we get this thing gets packaged in so many different ways. But we have the Lam Rim teachings. Basically, this is called the gradual path to enlightenment, or the graded path to enlightenment. It's a Tibetan term, and it summarizes all these teachings of the Buddha in a very workable, logical way where we can practice it and make some progress over time. So it includes not only the sutra teachings, but the tantric teachings, the Vajrayana teachings too. So this is the medicine. Sick, here's the cause of the illness, great news, we can be cured, and then here's the medicine. You have to take the medicine. So, again, how are we going to develop faith without having done the work, without having actually practiced the path? So again, this class is almost like, why are we doing this class? Because nobody's really had a chance to put this into practice, really. If we're all newbies, it's unusual to have an opportunity to really have a genuine taste of these teachings. And it takes years, it takes decades. The Dalai Lama, somebody was complaining to the Dalai Lama one time saying, I've been practicing for like 5 years or something like that. I don't really see much difference in my mind. And, of course, he didn't know what kind of practice. He says, don't judge your practice in terms of a few years. Judge it in terms of decades. Darn. It's not like Prozac. You take it and 3 weeks later you feel better. But no, we're talking about work over time. moderate effort over time. Don't burn yourself out, but just continue to go. Just every day, you do the work, and until your practice becomes literally 24/7. It is like continuous. You never stop practicing the Dharma. Now, we're lucky to do it, 15 minutes a day, but these great yogis, 24/7, everything becomes Dharma practice. They're able to use it to transform their minds. So, again, this is to help us. Understanding these and practicing this gives us a strong sense of concern or dread or fear. And understanding and practicing the second two truths gives us a sense of, of faith. But I said this earlier. I think the most helpful thing of all is to meet like a really great master. And if you're lucky enough, if you have, the karma to do that, I think that's the most inspiring thing that you can do to actually have a real sense of the possibility of the truth of cessation and that the path, you go, he's doing this. If you meet the Dalai, if you've ever been around the Dalai Lama or meet somebody like that, you go, he is doing this. And look at what a great human being he is. I mean, he's amazing. He's the fruit of this kind of effort over time. And so, that is very inspiring, much more inspiring than reading the words. But I think the most inspiring thing is the teacher and your own experience, your own valid experience of your mind changing in the direction you've always wanted it to. I remember, what's his name? Madison, Wisconsin. Geshe Sopa. So I went to Madison one time, and to study with this. Who was a teacher to my teachers, Geshe Sopa. He just died recently, and I asked him. I said, I'm blah, 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 blah. What do you think, how would you suggest, introducing people to the Dharma? And he said something. He said, tell them it's the answer to all their dreams. So if you dream of being a good, well, maybe not all of your dreams, but, if you dream of being an evil person, this is probably not your path. But if you want to be a, really, really, truly happy, satisfied person and joyful person and so on and so forth, I think people want to, we all have that basic goodness and we all want that. And we're just looking for a method to crack the nut to help us experience the full expression of that. And, for people that have the karmic connection with Buddhism, great, this may be your path. Now, I'm going to stop here for a minute. I'm going to ask people who, because some people here have been practicing, some people are brand new to this, but those of you, because I want to hear what people have to say about, what do you see as the possibility of this path for you? I'm not saying you've gotten there yet, but what have you seen for yourself, or what's attractive to you about this path? And this may be 5 or 6 people. Don't everybody's hand go up at one time. But what, go ahead.
A deeper happiness or a constant happiness where it's not dependent on anything around me or anything that I do.
Mm-hmm. So have you experienced that for yourself to some little degree? Is that something you've already tasted?
Yes, I've tasted it.
Mm-hmm. Good. We'll just stay here all night. I like the quiet.
Hello. I used to be, when I was younger, I was really concerned with, like, monumental change and helping other people change. And I used to be really overwhelmed by feeling like I needed to, like, organize people and to, like, instruct people. And I've benefited a lot from realizing the effect that changing yourself has on other people inexplicably. And that's really freed me from feeling like I needed to do things which would ended up being controlling other people and would have been really negative. So it's helped me to, in my work on myself, actually have the effect outwardly that I wanted in the first place.
Hmm. Thank you. One more person. Now I'm hot again. Suffering has changed.
Oh. Go ahead. What I found is I'm very grateful for is that first I became aware of how much I thought about myself all the time, and then to find that it starts coming more naturally to think about other people first. And that's what I've noticed. It's very gratifying.
So when I was a teenager, I read Siddhartha, you know, the Hermann Hesse novel, and I read The Razor's Edge, Somerset Maugham, and I saw the movie with Bill Murray, and I thought, wow, that's really cool. You know,
did you see the earlier one? There was one back
Tyrone.
Yeah, Powers.
What's his name? Powers.
That was a good too.
And I thought, this is really cool. These people have, like, special powers, and they're above it all, you know? Mm-hmm. And in college, I had a friend who was into TM, and she taught me how to meditate. And, you know, it kind of relaxed me. But I don't think it really clicked for me until, honestly, a couple months ago, where... And I think that it clicked for me because I realized that I was really suffering, and I wanted it to go away, and that was a motivation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I was diagnosed as chronic, so I was ready to take the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's not a bad place to be.
Yeah. So I'm not wanting to like have superhuman powers or.
Right.
Save other people. I'm not even all that concerned about other people. And it really comes out when I drive my car. You know? Especially when people are texting. You know? I'm not wishing them well.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now it's just really something selfish. Yeah. I just don't want to suffer.
Oh, that's... We call that having... We call it compassion for yourself. It's like the first... You know, again, lots of packages, but renunciation, which is the first step on the path, and we haven't used that word before, but it's renouncing suffering and its causes, and it really is coming to, it's like the jet fuel for practice, just like realizing, man, I am in a mess. This is not good, and it's not going to end well with this kind of mind. So that, and it is, in a sense, having compassion for yourself to say, hey, I'm going to do, see what a mess this is, and now I'm going to do something about it. But it's in the context of some faith, of some sense that it's possible. You still want to say, well, you know, to sit around and think about how terrible things are without seeing the possibility of improving could just make us more depressed, right? So, good, thank you. I'm gonna say too that I was talking to my, you know, to Robbie, and I was thinking about this class, and I thought I'm gonna cover the. We have one more after this before the practice day. So next time, does anybody know how to do PowerPoint? By the way,
I do.
Do you really? All right. Good. I might, if I give you something to, wait, we'll talk later. But anyway, I'd like to show you these lists and explain, and it doesn't take long to learn them. I mean, but it's not what people find inspiring about the Dharma. It's like coming to terms with our selfishness or what a mess we're in and seeing the possibility of getting free and seeing that, you know, that, trying to solve problems out there without working on ourselves first, you know, just creates more problems. Those kinds of insights, you know, being in a moment of confusion or frustration and then being able to stop yourself and make a better choice, all those kinds of things are just, to me, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's why we're here. So, you know, I want to do a meditation now that I find particularly helpful. We talk, again, when you hear the list in Buddhism, it's just daunting, so I apologize. But, you know, we'll have lots of lists next time, and I'm going to bring unsalted Ritz crackers for everybody to chew on while we're doing this. So you get a real, so you have something to do. But, you know, there's renunciation, okay, which is what we talked about, renouncing suffering and its causes, compassion for yourself. Then the next big part of the path is called bodhicitta. And it's really based on compassion for others, the awakening mind. It's the key part of the Mahayana practice. And then the last part has to do with wisdom, seeing things as they are. So we're going to talk more about the emptiness of inherent existence, you know, this whole notion of wisdom sounds so hard, you know, and it is. It's not something you can just instantly wrap our minds around, but just seeing that we project our reality all the time, hearing, smelling, tasting, tactile, mental, we project our whole world all the time, which is not a problem. The problem is we believe it. We believe in our projections as the truth, and then creates all kinds of problems for ourselves because we think, well, first of all, we project that we're the center of the universe and the most important one, and anybody who offends me instantly gets labeled, you know, adversary or somebody to be, you know, aversion. Feel aversion, right? We feel aversion toward people that bother us or say things that, you know, do whatever we don't like. And things that, people that do things that we do like, we feel attached to some degree. And so on. So, you know, we hallucinate a false sense of self, a whole world, which is not the problem. The problem is we believe it. If we could see that we're doing it and not believe it, we can still live our lives and function at a very high level, but we wouldn't get tagged. Can you imagine if somebody said, "You're a jerk," and you go, "Whew," just goes right by, because you don't care, because you know it's his stuff. And furthermore, there's no you. The you he's talking about is the one he sees. The one you know you are is not that one anyway. So we don't get tagged, you know. We don't get drawn into anger and fear and aggression and jealousy and pride and clingy attachment. We don't get drawn into that, which are all predicated on a false sense of I, one that's a mistake. So this is just a taste of the wisdom part of the path, which is everything we do in Buddhism is to set us up to realize the truth of reality. To be able to see things as they are, free of our projections. Not easy to do, but, you know, totally, the only way to stop our suffering is to have that experience. But the renunciation, compassion for ourselves is step one, bodhicitta is step two. So let's do a brief meditation on bodhicitta, because for me, when I heard these teachings, I found this to be the most inspiring part of it all, because I couldn't understand a word about emptiness. I thought, this is for the next life. But this little meditation is very, it's kind of, it resonated with me. So I'm gonna give you. We'll just kind of go into a trance, so to speak. You'll just listen, and you'll be thinking about the words I say. And I mean that's what I'd like for you to do anyway. And see if to see where this takes you. Sit up back straight. So the first step, I'm going to give you a kind of elaborate version of it on how to meditate on this. But the first step is to build a solid foundation called equanimity, because we don't want to, our goal is to get enlightened for the sake of all living beings, which includes our enemies, and it includes people that we don't even know, which is the people we don't know is the vast majority, or the sentient beings we don't know. That's the vast majority, isn't it? And the people that we dislike, we intensely dislike, and maybe most of us have one or two people like that, or have had them in our lives. So it's even for their sake. So we don't need to exclude anybody. So we want to build this level ground, this very firm foundation for this mansion of bodhicitta to manifest, to build it on. So what we, one of the ways we do that is we imagine in front of us is this faceless person that we call stranger, which are they're infinite strangers, right? Most of the people around us all day long are strangers if we get out and about. Then to the left is someone you feel attachment toward, like clingy attachment. Usually we call these people our friends, right? And then over here is somebody that we feel aversion towards on the right. And if you can actually bring to mind people and allow the feeling of aversion to arise and allow the experience of attachment to arise for the friend and allow the experience of indifference to arise for the stranger, it's perfectly acceptable here to allow these different experiences to come into your awareness and then begin to analyze and see that, well, is the friend always going to be my friend? Maybe not, but his relationships are changeable. The friend of today could be the enemy of tomorrow. And furthermore, we may have had experiences, most of us have, of people that we thought hated us or got labeled enemy for whatever reason, became either neutral or a friend. So these relationships, even all of our friends and enemies, came from the stranger group. We didn't always know them. So, we think these labels are so solid and real, but they're just always changing and are not stable. They're not the truth in some sense. And there's more reasoning, that sometimes we talk about, well, the friend is the friend of what? Our ego. Right? Is the friend of my worst enemy really my friend? Maybe not. Maybe not. Sometimes our friends don't tell us our faults. Our enemies, they're quick to point them out. And we should be grateful to have people to point out the areas where we need to work on. And who teaches us patience? It's certainly not our friends. It's the enemy, the person who aggravates us, who we feel aversion toward. They teach us tolerance and patience and so on. And, then again, you look at so many times people, just a few kind words to a stranger can turn them into at least a friendly acquaintance, and a few misplaced words to a stranger can turn them into an instant enemy. So it doesn't take much. So these labels are not so solid. So what we want to do is develop a feeling of, you know, equanimous feeling toward these three categories of beings. Friend and stranger and enemy. Changeable. Not inherently true. Just labels. Just labels. Then, the next meditation, and we'll go pretty quick through these. The first one is to see every living being, and don't try to do the math on this, as having been your mom. Okay, we've had to have a mother every time we got born. We've been born countless times, beginningless lifetimes, right? And I'm just inviting you to creatively align with this as a way to shift your mind. So, potentially it's possible. Every lifetime we had to have a mom. We're choosing that relationship because for most people it's the most important one. Not everybody. If it was somebody else who was kinder to you than your mom, you use that one. But, so, in every lifetime we've had a mom. And the mom of this lifetime has been our mom in former lifetimes and will again be our mom in future lifetimes. So, when we think like this, this person next to me has been my mom, behind me, in front of me, the people in the elevator, the people I walk with. You know, when we do this meditation well, no matter who we see, we feel instant connection. We don't understand why, but we feel instant connection. Then we meditate on the kindness of the mom. So if you're a mother, you know what moms have to go through, you know, particularly during the last month of pregnancy when you can't sleep because you've got this, you know, 25-pound bowling ball on your stomach and the baby's kicking all the time and it's very uncomfortable. And then, of course, the whole process of labor and delivery no matter how the baby comes out, it's not easy. And then the first 6 weeks after the baby's born, hardest 6 weeks of people's lives, generally speaking. So much effort to keep your sanity and keep the baby alive. It's incredible. And then it's just the beginning. And then, you know, your mom teaches you how to walk and talk and takes care of you and takes you to school and tells lies on your behalf and exaggerates your good qualities and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, and then you have the audacity to bring your dirty clothes home from college and have your mom wash them, and she doesn't even complain. It's amazing. And so we use this relationship to think about the kindness of the mom till we actually feel kindness toward our real mom. And we go, well, this person's been that kind to me. This person's been that kind to me. All these kind, mother sentient beings that are around me, they've all been kind to me. So now, walking down the street, if you've done these two meditations well, you go, not only do you feel connected, you feel a sense of warmth toward people you don't even know. This takes time. This takes time. And then the next step is recognizing that it's your it's my responsibility to repay the kindness of all these kind mother sentient beings. It's not, you know, it's not Geshe Gelug, it's not the Dalai Lamas, it's not anybody else's. You know, we take personal responsibility for repaying the kindness of all these kind mother sentient beings. So it's just a way of thinking. It's our, so we really want to repay the kindness. And the next meditation is called seeing the equality of self and other. Okay? We think of, and this is said to be like one of the best ways to develop genuine love, is to see that we all want exactly the same thing. It's just so not obvious when we listen to people. But when we start getting underneath it, we realize everybody's in it for the same thing. Wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. Wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. We're all 100% like that. Even little insects working so hard all day long, carrying ants and cockroaches, I don't care what it is, fish, any sentient being, all the time looking for, you know, sustenance, happiness, whatever they call it, and they don't want to be eaten, they don't want to suffer, they don't want to have a hard life. We're the same way. We want happiness, we don't want to suffer. It's something that we know very intimate about everyone. Next, tomorrow when you come up in front of people, just say it to yourself. Look them right in the eye, and you don't have to say it out loud, but you say, think, I got you. I know your modus operandi. I know exactly what makes you go. You want to be happy, and you don't want to suffer. And sometimes people do bizarre things, don't they? Including, like the most unthinkable thing of all, to take your own life. Because it's so painful that death looks like happiness. So we all are motivated by that same motive. I want to be happy, don't want to suffer. We're all equal. So in this way, in this important way, we're equal. And so we meditate about that, the quality of self in others. Then we meditate on the fault of self-cherishing selfishness. And, you know, and if you think about it, killing and stealing and adultery and lying and bad-mouthing other people and harsh speech and wasting people's time with idle gossip, greed, hatred, closed-minded ignorance, and all the delusions come right out of it. Self-centered selfishness. And I talked about it a moment ago. I, me, me. You affront me, you get, you know, I'm going to yell at you, you get labeled enemy. You say something nice to me, or you're sweet to me, you're kind to me, you get labeled friend, you get labeled object of attachment, like that. So all of our delusions, all the suffering, from the beginning of beginningless time until now, is the fault of one demon. This is the Buddhist view. The demon is selfishness. Self-cherishing selfishness, and it lies in, right in our hearts, is ignorance. It's not seeing how we exist. It's believing in this false sense of I and clinging to it and thinking we're the center of the universe and the most important one, and we're so selfish and self-centered, and it creates all the problems, all the problems. And you have to get, you know, this is worth checking into. Because this is how we think. Normally people don't think that way. I don't think. Maybe they do, but I don't think they do. And then the cause of happiness is cherishing others. The cause of suffering, cherishing oneself only. The cause of happiness, cherishing others. So, you know, Lama Zopa hit a bumper sticker some years ago. For happiness, cherish others. For happiness, cherish others. Self-centeredness, the energy is going this way, isn't it? Like right toward the, you know, in the middle of your chest kind of thing. And, you know, focusing out and cherishing others and thinking about others and their happiness and their well-being and focusing on them, cherishing them, is the true cause of happiness. We wouldn't kill, would we? We'd do the opposite. We'd save lives. We wouldn't steal. We'd do the opposite. We'd be generous. We wouldn't commit adultery. We'd do the opposite. We would practice, you know, proper, I guess the word is sexual ethics. We'd be mindful of other people's feelings. We wouldn't take advantage of them and their relationships. We wouldn't lie. We'd be truthful. We wouldn't slander. We'd praise other people and so on. So you can see how cherishing others is the source of all happiness. So the next meditation is exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others. It's just mental, I don't know if the word's a keto, but it's kind of, we're just mentally playing with this notion of, okay, today I'm getting up and I'm going to cherish others. I'm exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others. So you get out of bed. Tonight, we dedicate the teachings tonight. When we finish for others. You drive home carefully for others. You go to sleep to get a good night's rest so you can better serve others tomorrow. You get up, you clean up, you do your best for others. Everything is other-oriented. Okay, so tomorrow and for the rest of our lives as much as possible, we're exchanging our ordinary instinctive self-centeredness for cherishing others, because that's the cause of happiness. And it's what we want. And the next meditation, the next contemplation, and I'm skipping over really one important one called taking and giving, Tonglen, but maybe we'll do that next week. But the next one is the contemplation that this is the Bodhisattva's attitude. It's like, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all sentient beings. And try that one on. But it's based on what? It's based on genuine love and compassion. Not on, Napoleonic complex or egocentricity. It's not based on that. It's based on love and compassion and recognition of the suffering of sentient beings and not being able to bear it another moment, like your only child is suffering. You know, I am personally responsible to stop the suffering of all sentient beings and to establish them in the supreme happiness of liberation and enlightenment. It's my job. I'm taking it on. It's called a supreme wish. It's the vow of a bodhisattva, a spiritual warrior. And of course, if it could have been done, it would have been done. It's an attitude that we're trying to develop. It's a heroic attitude. It's not based on ego, not at all. And if it is, you become Darth Vader instead of the Dalai Lama, you know. You go in the wrong direction. It has to come from your heart. Excuse me. And then the last meditation is called the Generating Bodhicitta. It's recognition that we don't have our act together. We have a lot of work to do. What we want to do is to help others, to help them have food, clothing, and shelter and their basic necessities. And once that's been handled, we want to help them find, their own truth. And to help them to develop themselves spiritually so they can solve their own problems all the way up to supreme enlightenment. And our aim is to do that. And to do that, we have to get our act together because we're not there yet. So the goal, the goal is supreme enlightenment. I must become enlightened in order to help others. And it's kind of like this, it's almost like this. I must help others. And how do I do that? I get my act together. I stop being part of the problem. I start being part of the solution. I slowly, gradually, over lifetimes maybe, as long as it takes, I develop my heart and mind in a positive way so that more and more I can help others. So again, the goal is to help others, and the method is to achieve enlightenment. And there's so many gradations between where we are now to supreme enlightenment. But we have the courage to start on that path. And it is based on something that is like in your heart, that you really feel you want to help others stop their suffering. And this attitude is totally antithetical to selfishness. So it's not easy to even think this way. you call it, in the beginning, for most of us, it's called effortful bodhicitta. Because it takes effort to generate these thoughts. And later on, with practice, you know, years and years and years and maybe lifetimes of practice, becomes effortless. And then somebody who's effortlessly has this spontaneous wish for enlightenment for the sake of others, is called a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva. So we, you know, as much as we can, we want to develop this. All right, so relax your concentration, and let's do the dedication verses. On page 246, there's a nice dedication. We'll do that one. Next week I have a really nifty handout with all the information that you need to pass the exam. Alright. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the suffering of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creatures suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay, thank you. I went over 6 minutes. Sorry. But so we have one more class, and then we have practice evening. So the practice evening is, we'll go over, it'll be fun, but we'll go over the, we'll do some contemplative meditations, but we will do these meditations on the three principles of the path, the things that I was telling you about. So you get, because I think that's how you understand whether Buddhism is worth practicing or not, or committing to, is you understand what these three principles are. And not only intellectually, but, you know, seeing your own life through the lens of these teachings. So, well, what time are we supposed to start? I think it starts at, 6 or 6:30. What is it? Does anybody? Is it 6:30? Well, 6:30 to 9, maybe, like that. Okay. 2 weeks. Yeah, we're still here. We got one more class next week. Next week will be, please come, because this is an opportunity to learn, you know, and ask questions about what the traditional teachings have to say about what, you know, what constitutes someone who wants to do this practice. And maybe you do, maybe you don't. And some of you have already committed and would like to know what you committed to. So this will be a good opportunity. So anyway, thank you.